With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What is Malice After Midnight? Well, it's a podcast hosted by three people, Steve, Tina, and Christine, with a focus on true crime, but we save room for all things involving malice, serving it up with a bit of dark humor tucked in here and there. We welcome you to the conversation with the release of a new episode every Sunday on all podcast platforms.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The Oracle Network.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. Stay tuned at the end of the episode for your Patreon shoutouts and to learn more about the Reverie True Crime Patreon. Never take a ride from a stranger, and definitely don't go into the woods with one. On August 15, 1994, Stanley Burden met a man while leaving a restroom at Lions Park in Fort Myers, Florida. Later, Stanley walked to a street corner by a hamburger joint, and he was encountered by the same man in a light-colored Plymouth or Dodge station wagon with red and green interior and dark tinted windows. Stanley is now a convicted pedophile. At the time, he was a high school dropout who had trouble keeping a steady job. He said that this man supposedly told him that he would pay $100 to $150 to pose naked while being bound with rope to a tree. Stanley said he was fine with doing some nude modeling for money, but this sexual bondage photo shoot turned horrible quickly. After Stanley agreed to this offer, a male, only known to him as Dan, drove him to a rocky dirt road in an isolated location where he pulled out a duffel bag, a tarp, and a Polaroid camera. They went off into the woods and Dan laid out the tarp, asking Stanley to remove his shirt and show him a little hip. This Dan character did take some pictures, but he told Stanley to stand up against a tree as he took out a new pack of clothesline, wrapping it around Stanley to make it look like a bondage photo shoot. When Dan went around the tree behind Stanley, he snatched the rope tightly around him. He pulled Stanley's hands behind the tree and put ropes around Stanley's legs, chest, and twice around his neck. Stanley started to notice that he couldn't move his arms at all. Daniel started to force himself orally onto Stanley's penis, but he was pissed off when Stanley did not get an erection. Dan started to choke him with the rope, but Stanley turned his head to one side so he could still get air. It lasted for about 20 or 30 minutes. Even after Stanley would pass out and come back too. This man was trying to rape Stanley as he turned him to the side and said, "Give up and let me do my job." He tried his hardest to sodomize Stanley, but Dan was the one who gave up first. Stanley thought Daniel was tired from the struggle, because at one point he yelled, "Why won't you die?" The man said that he would give Stanley $100 just to keep quiet about the whole thing, but he never paid him anything. He did, however, pack up his things and left Stanley tied up to the tree, hoping that he would die. After Stanley was able to get loose and out of the woods, he went to a local hospital to get treated for his wounds. Stanley reported the assault on August 15, 1994. The police went to the scene and found one of the tree's ligature indentions that definitely matched Stanley's injuries. Now, I'm going to be talking about a location in Florida, and I looked up how to pronounce this name correctly. And a lot of people seem to pronounce it differently. Some say Punta Gorda, and some say Punta Gorda. So if I'm mispronouncing this name, I do apologize. In February of 1994, in a wooded area of Punta Gorda, a male's nude corpse, with few teeth, and basically very few identifying features, were found. In many sources, it says the man's genitals have been removed, and he had marks of rope burns and was only known as John Doe Number 1 until very recently. Of course, I will explain more about this man, only known for years as John Doe Number 1, later. Bodies were being found all in these woods, and they were still being found in 2007. These woods were known stomping grounds for hogs, so the media started calling the murders the Hog Trail Killings, and the killer was known as the Hog Trail Killer. This was only the beginning, so let's get started. Daniel Owen Conahan Jr. was born on May the 11th, 1954, in Charlotte, North Carolina. Not long after his mother gave birth to him, off they went to Punta Gorda, Florida, to live. As a teenager in the late 1960s, Daniel realized he was not into girls. He was into guys, and his parents were disappointed and disgusted by it. So much so, they forced him to go to many psychiatrists to find out what was quote-unquote wrong with him and how they could fix him to basically make him straight. In 1973, Daniel received his high school diploma from Miami Norland High School, and 4 years later, he joined the U.S. Navy. Naval Station Great Lakes in Illinois is where he was based. And Daniel began getting a little out of control with his sexual urges. After he was caught luring other officers off the base to engage in sex at a nearby motel in 1978, he almost had to go to military court for it, but reportedly none of the men wanted to testify against Daniel. A few months later, Daniel tried to orally rape another man, and this turned into a serious fight. Daniel was then discharged from the Navy. Instead of going back to Florida after he was discharged, he lived in Chicago, Illinois for 13 years. Chicago is only about an hour away from where his naval station was. Harold Lind met Daniel in a bar in Chicago. They ended up being in a romantic relationship and lived together in Chicago from 1988 through 1992. Daniel told Harold about a sexual fantasy that he would like to, quote, like to pick up a boy hitchhiking, go in the woods, tie him up to a tree, and fuck him, end quote. At the time of Daniel's trial, Harold accused the prosecution of making a big thing out of nothing. Harold did not believe Daniel was guilty. Daniel never asked Harold to go out in the woods to tie him up and have sex, and never told him he had done this with someone else. Daniel mentioned the fantasy only one time. Their relationship did not involve any type of bondage. Each of them went their separate ways and dated other people. Daniel did not discuss any other sexual fantasies. Harold was still in love with Daniel at the time of the trial. After 13 years of living in Chicago, Daniel decided to go to Florida in 1993 to live with his parents, who were now senior citizens, in Punta Gorda. A year after Daniel did those horrible things to Stanley Burden, he was going about his life as if he was Mr. Innocent. Daniel graduated from Charlotte Vocational Technical Center in 1995 at the top of his class, and he was now a licensed practical nurse and worked at the Charlotte Regional Medical Center. But ever since Daniel made his return to Florida, dead, mutilated bodies were being found scattered all throughout the woods. In early 1996, four male corpses were found, and they all had wounds that were similar to each other. Police started to realize they were likely dealing with a serial killer, and who knows when he may strike again. On the 1st of January, 1996, in Northport, one of my personal worst fears happened. A family had let their dog out to run around and explore. When their dog came back, he had a human skull to show his family. The skull was determined to be that of a male. When the police went into the woods, they were able to find the remainders of the skeleton that went with that skull. It was concluded that again, the man's genitals had been removed. This body has not been identified. March 7th, 1996, in Northport, yet another body was found, and it was concluded that the body had been there for maybe 10 days at the most. 3 years later, June 1999, police were finally able to put a name to the John Doe. This man was 35-year-old John William Malaragno. He was originally from Ohio and was taken back there to have proper burial by his paternal grandparents. Keep in mind, this is not John Doe number one. Thomas Reese and Michael Tisch. They were two storm utility engineers for Charlotte County and stumbled across a human skull on April 17th, 1996. They called the police right away, in complete shock at what they were seeing. When the police showed up and started investigating the scene, another body was found, but this time it was a bit different. Not just a skull or skeletons. 21-year-old Richard Allen Montgomery had only been missing for a day when the police found him. The timeline from when he went missing to when he was found gave many clues that helped narrow down a suspect, and Richard was easier to identify. Richard had been sodomized, killed, signs of trauma to the neck, waist, wrists, his genitals had been cut off, and he was mutilated. Richard resided with his sister and was with his friends Bobby Whitaker, Gary Mason, and others when Richard told them he was about to go make a few hundred dollars and it wouldn't be long before he would be back. One of the friends asked, "Hey, is it legal?" Richard just smiled and said he would be safe. That is the last time his friends would ever see him alive again. He did tell his mother that he had an offer to pose nude for photographs for $200, but he never told her who the photographer was. However, while talking to his mom in passing, he did say he recently met a guy named Daniel who who was a nurse at a medical center. So here's a little bit about Richard Montgomery from court records. Mary West was a nurse and Richard Montgomery's mother. Richard lived with his sister Carla and her husband Jeff in April of 1996. Before that, he had lived with his mom, her father, and her other son, 8-year-old Danny. Richard had also lived in his own apartment or trailer for a while, and with Bobby Whitaker. Richard was 21 years old, and he was born on March 6, 1975, in Willard, Ohio. He was almost 6 feet tall and weighed between 150 and 160 pounds. He was thin, yet muscular. Richard had a problem being employed and had quit a job with a roofing company. He was fired from other jobs for partying and missing work. He was arrested as a juvenile, and he had struggled with schoolwork. He was emotionally handicapped and had been in and out of therapy. He was often absent from school and quit when he was 18 without receiving a high school diploma. Richard had trouble with alcohol and smoked marijuana. He told his mother on January 6, 1993, that he had been sexually abused. At other times, he would deny it. His only substantial possessions were a gold necklace and a stereo. He had a happy-go-lucky attitude. His mom, Mary, bought him a truck, but she took it away because he had numerous speeding tickets. From then on, Richard got around by riding his bicycle or by getting rides with friends. After he had had a few drinks, he was way too trusting of other people. Bobby Whitaker went to Richard's funeral and appeared to be really upset. In the past, Richard had told his mother that he didn't like the way Bobby would look at him, and he sometimes made him uncomfortable. The last time she saw her son was on March 23rd. He told her that he had a new friend named Daniel, who lived in Punta Gorda and had been in the Navy, was a nurse at a medical center where Mary had worked, and was much older than he was. Richard's mom now lives near Orlando. She had to move, she said, because everywhere she went just brought back so many memories of her son. She described Richard as fun-loving and good-hearted. Mary said, quote, "He always gave his things away, his clothes, his food, everything but his cowboy boots, and I buried him in them." End quote. Richard Montgomery is buried in Royal Palm Memorial Garden.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, Richard stayed with his friend Bobby Whitaker for about 2 weeks. Richard was complaining that Bobby watched him in the shower and asked him to have oral sex. So his sister Carla's husband, Jeff, told him to come home. Around 4:30 p.m. or later Tuesday, April 16, 1996, Jeff was returning home from work with a guy named Ray when they saw Richard walking towards Cox Lumber at the corner of Royal Road and Taylor Road. Ray honked the horn, and Richard waved his hand and kept walking along. Gary Mastin met Richard Montgomery at Bobby Whitaker's trailer about 2 weeks before Richard's murder. On Tuesday, April 16, 1996, Gary saw Richard at Bobby's trailer between 1 and 4 in the afternoon. Richard said he was going out to make some money, and he would be back in about 30 minutes. Bobby asked him if it was legal. Richard said that if it wasn't legal, he would tell him, and then he smiled. Richard might have been under the influence of alcohol at this time, but he was walking fine. Also, Bobby had met Richard about 6 months before Richard's death. It was said that Richard was outgoing and caring, but mentally slow. Bobby Whitaker met Daniel Conahan through a friend named Jeff Dingman about 2 years before he met Richard. Daniel came to Bobby's trailer to see Jeff about 3 times. Daniel came to the trailer to see Richard 1 time while he was living with Bobby, and 2.5 to 3 months before he was killed. Daniel Conahan said Richard's sister Carla told him he was there. This is when Richard tells Bobby that he was going out to make some quick money, and when Bobby asked him again if it was legal, Richard said that he would be safe, and that's the last that anyone ever saw of him. So, the first skull the storm utility engineers came across when they initially called police turned out to be Kenneth Lee Smith. Arriving at the scene next was a forensic lab employee who carefully gathered many items from this awful scene. Among the items collected were rope on top of a trash pile nearby, carpet padding that was covering Richard's body, a skull and a torso that were not Richard's, a gray coat, a few combings from Richard's arms, hands, chest, pubic region, and thighs. Richard Montgomery's autopsy did prove that his cause of death was strangulation. He had 2 ligature marks on the front of his neck, 2 horizontal marks on the right side of his chest, and abraded grooves around his wrists. Since the grooves on his wrist did not prove to be bound to his back, it was concluded that these marks pointed to him being tied up to one of the trees. Due to the murder being so unique, it stood out to the police so much that they went back and reviewed the assault that was reported on August 15, 1994 by Stanley Burden. Based on that report and the similarities in the assault of Stanley and murder of Richard, the police decided to go undercover and investigate Daniel Conahan. Some reports say that the investigation was also pushed forward with the help of David Payton. David Payton made his escape when Daniel's car got stuck while he was driving the two down a dirt road. Daniel got out to push the car, and David noticed a tarp, a knife, and a rope in the back seat, and he darted into the driver's seat. While David was sitting there, another vehicle pulled up, and he noticed that Daniel started acting really weird. All of these things freaked him out so bad that he floored the gas of Daniel's car and was gone. David Payton pled guilty to car theft and was sent to prison. So, David was still in prison for taking off in Daniel's car when he was hearing about the deaths of Richard Montgomery and Kenneth Smith. He got in touch with police and told them they should be looking into Daniel Conahan. David went on to work with authorities in a sting operation to try and get information out of Daniel. David Payton has since been released. According to court documents and officials involved in the case, they have no idea where David Payton is today. Police started to watch Daniel Conahan, and a mobile tracking device was put on his vehicle. Daniel's defense attorney said, quote, "Every time he left his house, they had 6 cars bracketing him. They had overhead aerial surveillance. They had his house under 24-hour surveillance with video cameras," end quote.
During our surveillance, we noticed something about Conahan, that there was only certain times he would come out of the house with his backpack. And generally that was the times or when he was really looking. We thought the backpack probably contained a murder kit. There was one time where he met a subject at Alligator Creek Dam. Picked him up. And they ended up going out to a dirt road and went back into the woods. We were really concerned at this point because that was one of those days. He had came out with the backpack.
Everybody's thinking, okay, we've got to save this guy's life because he's going to kill this guy. We didn't want to blow our cover. We're all undercover, driving undercover vehicles. So we called for a marked patrol car to come in and do an accidental, oh, what are you guys doing here, and do what we call an FI, a field interview.
Okay. Can I take ma'am?
Ask them why they're back here, you know, just to know that the cops are here. Well, that's what they did. They went back there, they made contact, they did field interrogation cards, and we averted anything that could have happened.
I believe we saved this guy's life.
A spokesperson for the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office said, quote, during our 50 days of surveillance on him, we did have two separate instances where we had undercover detectives who posed as homeless men. They stood on the side of US 41, and while they were wearing a wire, Daniel actually did approach two of these men about going and having them pose nude in the woods, end quote. On the afternoon of May 17th, 1996, Charlotte County Sheriff's Deputy Raymond Weir posed as a homeless person holding a sign that said, Disabled Vet, and he was on the corner of Kings Highway and US 41 in Port Charlotte as part of the police surveillance of Daniel Conahan. Daniel drove up in a gray station wagon with dark tinted windows. Daniel handed the undercover deputy a dollar bill and asked if he was interested in work. Deputy Raymond replied that he had a bad back, but he would be interested if it was not too hard. Daniel said he might see him tomorrow and drove away. The next afternoon, May 18th, Deputy Raymond was at the same location wearing a transmitter. Daniel drove up again in the same car and gave him another dollar. Daniel asked him if he did any modeling and said that it paid $150. The light changed and Daniel drove around the block. He said it was kinky, nude modeling with a progressive bondage scene. Daniel noticed a police car and arranged to meet the undercover deputy around 3 o'clock in the afternoon the next day. Around 3:30 p.m. on May 23, 1996, Charlotte County Sheriff's Deputy Scott Clemens went to Kiwanis Park to attempt to contact Daniel. The deputy was dressed in shorts, a tank top, and boots, and had an undercover transmitter. The deputy walked down a trail and became involved in a conversation with a man named Rick. Daniel walked up, began talking to Rick, then walked away on the trail. 5 minutes later, Deputy Scott Clemens walked to the bathroom at the center of the park. As the deputy left the bathroom, Daniel walked up to him and started a conversation. Daniel told him that he would give him $7 if Scott showed him his penis, even offering to go to the ATM to get $20 if the deputy would let him give him a blowjob. Deputy Scott acted hesitant and said he wanted the money up front. They walked to Daniel's vehicle, and Daniel gave the deputy his phone number and asked him to call. At 2 p.m. on Friday, May 24th, 1996, Deputy Scott returned to Kiwanis Park. He saw an unknown white male walk out of a trail with Daniel behind him. The man stormed into the bathroom, struck something, yelled an obscene word, then went to his vehicle. Daniel walked up and sat beside Scott. Daniel asked him to model for some nude photos at a beach or in a hotel room for $150, and that he would be using a Polaroid camera. Daniel also offered him $5 if he would just go ahead and show him his penis. Deputy Scott refused. They walked to his vehicle, and Daniel repeated the $5 offer. Daniel was pulled over on a vehicle-related police concern towards the end of May in 1996. The authorities carried him to a hotel room, which they had set up for a videotaped interrogation. While the police were interrogating him, they were also completing a search warrant for his residence and for both his and his dad's vehicles. On the tape, Daniel is clad in a polo shirt and sporting aviator shades. Chain-smoking cigarettes, and all of his responses to their questions were, "Oh my gosh, oh my gosh, why me? What brought you to me?" When a detective told Daniel, "Right now you're a suspect," he responded, "Wow." The interrogation lasted for 3 hours. Here's a small snippet of that interrogation.
Conahan was very smart, and sometimes that works to their disadvantage, because when people are very smart, they think that, you know, I can get over on this guy and I'm going to walk out of here and they're going to look somewhere else. They get maybe overly confident, and that was working for us in this case.
We haven't talked about it yet. I suspect you're involved. I suspect that running out. Maybe you're going to smell it.
Maybe I'm not involved, all right? I've had fantasies about the bondage and stuff, but I'm not engaged in that.
He denied being involved in any, you know, any bondage or offering people, you know, money.
And all the people in your lifestyle we've talked to, you're the only one that has talked about having fantasies and discussing those fantasies about wanting to tie somebody up and take pictures of them.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people all over that do that. There's people that make a living selling magazines doing that. There's people that, you know, We all have fantasies we've not lived out.
He didn't really have an alibi. His alibi was, I just didn't do it. Eventually, I can tell he's getting tired. He's getting to the point where he may be feeling a little bit threatened. So I decided that it was time to shut the interview down, because I wanted another chance to interview him, because I knew at some point we're going to be arresting him.
You all set?
Yeah.
So I wanted to leave on a good note, and that's the way we ended it.
Thank you for your time.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
May 31st, 1996. The police had a warrant to search Daniel's house and vehicles. Photos taken during the search showed Daniel's bedroom, a black backpack, an open closet, a silver Plymouth station wagon, and a blue Mercury Capri automobile. There were vacuum sweepings gathered from the floor of the bedroom and the bedroom furniture. The backpack, vacuum sweepings from the Plymouth station wagon, carpet, and upholstery samples from the Plymouth station wagon. Also, vacuum sweepings and paint samples from the Mercury Capri. Photos of the Mercury Capri, which was his father's car that Daniel sometimes would drive as well, showed that the paint was peeling off. Hair, blood, and saliva samples were also taken from Daniel and sent to the FDLE laboratory on July 16, 1996. Also, on May 31, 1996, Lieutenant Michael Gandy of the Charlotte County Sheriff's Department interviewed Daniel Conahan. Daniel indicated that he had access to the blue Mercury Capri and had last driven it about a month or a month and a half before the interview. The paint samples from the car and a paint chip that came from Richard's pubic hair and thigh area were compared, and it was found that both paint samples were identical. FDLE agent James Myers searched the cars again after they were impounded. He collected a blue and yellow beach towel, a green toolbox, and some rope from the Plymouth station wagon. He collected a blue tarp and a blue baseball cap from the Mercury Capri. During the course of the investigation, Agent Myers had observed Daniel driving the Plymouth station wagon. FDLE analyst Christopher Hendry recovered trace evidence from the carpet pad, the white towel used to cover Richard Montgomery's face, the sheet used to transport Richard's body, and the sheets and plastic bags that were used to transport Kenneth Smith's dismembered body parts. FDLE analyst Christine Nickerson recovered trace evidence from the coat found at the scene, the blue ball cap, the backpack, the yellow and blue beach towel, and the blue tarp. She collected fiber samples from the backpack and the blue tarp. She also collected a hair sample from Kenneth Smith's dismembered body. Charlotte County Sheriff's Detective Robert Rowell transported Kenneth's body parts from the Charlotte County Medical Examiner's Office to the Sarasota Medical Examiner's Office. FDLE agent Michael Rafferty went to the Sarasota Medical Examiner's Office, where Associate Medical Examiner James Wilson collected hair and bone samples from Kenneth Smith's body parts. Agent Rafferty then transported the samples to the Fort Myers Crime Lab. He turned them over to Agent Sharon Fiola, who then turned them over to Detective Lehrman for transport to the Tampa Crime Lab. So instead of going down these long lists of fibers, I'll just say a majority of the combings from Richard's body, the evidence found in the vehicles, Daniel's bedroom, and the vacuum sweeps. There were many, many links to Richard Montgomery, as well as some to Kenneth Smith and Stanley Burden. Police arrested Daniel Conahan on July 3, 1996. Witnesses such as Stanley decided to tell their stories about their encounters with Daniel to officers and investigators. Stanley Burden was an especially important witness in Daniel's trial. He was attacked by Daniel's lawyer by trying to condemn his credibility, because at this time, Stanley was a convicted pedophile. Which we know, two things can be true at once. He can be a disgusting, twisted, sick pedophile, and at the same time, he still had something horribly traumatic done to him. Being a pedophile does not make you automatically a liar. It does make you a sickening piece of shit, though. More evidence in this case were business records from a Walmart which showed a credit card purchase at 6:07 p.m. on April 16, 1996. It was a package of clothesline, Polaroid film, pliers, and a utility knife for a total of $31.08. Citibank Choice Visa records showed that this purchase was made on Daniel O. Conahan's account. Law enforcement officers used the UPC codes from the receipt to purchase samples of the same merchandise. Another receipt showed that Daniel Conahan made a $10.56 credit card purchase at the same store at 3:41 p.m. on August 15, 1994. Nation's bank records showed a $40 ATM cash withdrawal from Daniel Conahan's account on April 16, 1996. This bank was on the corner of Madrid and 41 by Juicy Lucy and a mobile station. The Walmart store was nearby. Still photographs taken from the ATM video surveillance film showed Daniel making the withdrawal at 6:12 p.m. on April 16, 1996. Bank records also showed a May 6, 1996 payment of $105 to Daniel's Citibank Choice Visa account by a check drawn on Daniel's Nations Bank checking account. Nations bank records also showed a check for $20 paid to Bank One Visa account from Daniel's account in 1994, and a check for $30 to the same Bank One Visa account between August 22, 1994 and September 23, 1994. Bank One Visa records for Daniel Conahan's account, which had the same number, showed that $10.56 purchase at Walmart on August 15, 1994, and a payment on the account on September 8, 1994. So they definitely had all of the receipts. As I mentioned earlier, there was evidence linking Kenneth Smith's murder back to Daniel. However, the court ruled that the evidence concerning Kenneth Smith, including fibers found on his body parts, was inadmissible and would not be considered in determining Daniel Conahan's innocence or guilt. On February 25, 1997, the Charlotte County Grand Jury indicted Daniel for four offenses allegedly committed upon Richard Montgomery on April 16, 1997. Count 1, first-degree premeditated murder. Count 2, first-degree felony murder during the commission of or attempt to commit kidnapping. Count 3, kidnapping with intent to commit or facilitate the commission of sexual battery. And count 4, sexual battery. On August 9, 1999, Daniel waived his right to a jury trial for the determination of his guilt. Allegedly, he was nervous that he would get a jury full of conservatives that would already be against him just because he was a gay man. The case went to trial before Judge William L. Blackwell. At the close of the state's case, the court granted the defense counsel's motion for judgment of acquittal on count 4, sexual battery. The court denied the defense counsel's motion for judgment of acquittal on the other three counts. Florida State Prison inmate John Newman, who was serving sentences for manslaughter and marijuana at the time of his trial, met Daniel while sharing a cell in the Lee County Jail for 7 or 8 months. Daniel was being held on kidnapping and sexual battery charges from a Fort Myers case. He kept most of his discovery and 13 other papers concerning his case in the cell. John had been indicted for first-degree murder. He negotiated a deal for a 12-year sentence to run concurrently with a previously imposed 10-year sentence in exchange for his testimony against Daniel. John testified that Daniel originally said He did not know Richard Montgomery. But later, Daniel said he did know Richard, that they went on a few beer runs together. He said that he had been to Richard's house a few times and knew his sister, Carla. He said he and Richard went to the bank. Daniel also said, quote, Montgomery was a mistake. Following closing arguments, the court found Conahan guilty of count 1, first-degree premeditated murder, and count 3, kidnapping. The court granted defense counsel's motion for change of venue to Collier County for the penalty phase jury trial, which was conducted on November 1st through the 3rd, 1999. On December 10th, 1999, the court sentenced Daniel to death for count 1, first-degree premeditated murder, and to 15 years in prison for count 3 of kidnapping. The state dismissed count 2, which was first-degree felony murder. The sentencing guidelines provided a sentencing range of 48 to 80 months for kidnapping, but the court gave no written reason for a departure sentence. In support of the death sentence, the court found 3 aggravating circumstances. The murder was committed during the commission of a kidnapping. The murder was cold, calculated, and premeditated. And the murder was heinous, atrocious, or cruel. The defense stated that the court rejected the statutory mitigating circumstance that the victim was a participant in the defendant's conduct or consented to the act. On December 17, 1999, the court granted the defense counsel's motion to reduce the kidnapping sentence to 80 months. January 7, 2000, defense counsel filed Conahan's notice of appeal. All of Daniel's appeals have been denied, and he still sits on death row. From the year 2000 to 2007, more bodies have been found in the woods that Richard and Kenneth's remains were found, and neighboring woods. There was a mass grave discovered in 2007 in the original woods where Richard and Kenneth were found. One body was identified as 21-year-old Eric Collier, or Kohler. All of these dead men are suspected to be Daniel Conahan's victims. In the beginning of the episode, I mentioned John Doe number 1. On June 11th, 2021, Oxygen.com posted an update on the man who has gone unidentified for so many years. John Doe number 1 has finally been identified as Gerald Jerry Lombard from Massachusetts. His family said he was a drifter. Construction workers found his body in February of 1994 in the woods. His body was so badly decomposing, naked, no ID, and very few teeth, which all made it so difficult to find out who he was. Jerry's body was only 2,600 feet away from Richard and Kenneth's bodies. Daniel Conahan, authorities said, is definitely a viable suspect in Jerry's killing, and others. For many years, Jerry's remains had been used over and over by investigators to try to figure out who he was. They even had one of his teeth sent off to see if they could get any DNA hits in the database, but initially there were none. In January of 2020, the FBI was contacted by investigators. They wanted to know if a forensic genetic genealogy test may establish whose DNA this was. Later on in the year, it was revealed to the cold case team that it was possible to perform a genealogy search, and members of the FBI were able to use information that was available in family genealogy websites to figure out who John Doe number 1's family members could be. Investigators said, quote, After contacting the family, it was determined that this was a large family of 17 siblings, and one of the brothers, Jerry, had not been seen or heard from since approximately 1991 or 1992. Investigators collected DNA samples from one of Jerry's sisters, one of his brothers, and Jerry's son. There was a positive match between Jerry and his son, verifying that John Doe number 1 is Jerry Lombard. Investigators are asking that anyone with information about Jerry Lombard or Daniel Conahan to contact authorities at 941-639-2101. Now, here is a letter that isn't dated that I believe he wrote to a news outlet, and he titled this letter, Intro to My Case. My name is Daniel O. Conahan, Jr. I am a gay white male, 45 years of age. I have recently been found guilty of the murder of a young man named Richard Montgomery here in Punta Gorda, Florida. The guilt phase of my trial started on August 9, 1999, and lasted about a week. The sentencing phase of my trial started on November 1, 1999, and lasted about a week, where I have been given the penalty of death. The local law enforcement agencies have made it quite clear to the public for over the past 3 years that they believe I am a serial killer and responsible for the death of Richard Montgomery, as well as 5 other bodies found from 1993 to 1996 in northern Charlotte County and in southern Sarasota County here in southwest Florida. All the bodies were found in different stages of decomposition and in isolated areas. These deaths were investigated by a tri-county task force consisting of detectives and supported by people from Charlotte, Sarasota, and Lee counties, headed by case agent Ricky Hobbs, accompanied by the FDLE and the state attorney's office here in the 20th Circuit Court of Florida. I sat from July 3, 1996 to August 9, 1999, over 3 years under the same information before going to trial. 7 months for the attempted murder of a Mr. Burden. Mr. Burden stated on August 15, 1994, I had tied him to a tree under the guise of taking nude pictures, then tried to strangle him to death. This is not so. Mr. Burden is a self-admitted habitual liar, has stated this in police interviews as well as his testimony in court, and further stated he could pass a lie detector test because he is a habitual liar. Mr. Burden said he saw me driving in an area of Fort Myers, known as a place where male prostitutes hang out, called Lions Park. Mr. Burden said he saw me driving around that area at approximately 5:30 in the morning, 6:30 in the morning, 11 in the morning, and 12 in the afternoon on August 15, 1994. This is impossible, since I was in a clinical school day in my LPN class from Charlotte Votech at 5:45 a.m. to 1:45 p.m. in a hospital, and it was well over an hour drive to Fort Myers. Mr. Burden is currently serving a 10 to 25 year sentence in another state for child molestation. In one of his 3 inconsistent police interviews taken by detectives at prison of Mr. Burden, the detectives come right out and tell Mr. Burden, quote, "You scratch our back and we'll scratch yours." All charges for the attempted murder of Mr. Burden were dropped by the state on February 28, 1997, in Fort Myers, and I was then charged with the murder of Richard Montgomery on the same day, February 28, 1997, here in Charlotte County. Mr. Burden was then used as a witness by the state in the guilt phase of my trial. From February 28, 1997, I had to wait approximately another 2.5 years until I was taken to trial on August 9, 1999. I told the judge and my attorneys I wanted to be taken to trial much sooner. I wrote my own motions in an effort to bring myself to trial within a reasonable time as provided by the Florida Rules of Criminal Procedure on state and federal constitutional grounds. The circuit court here denied all of my motions I filed, stating I was provided with court-appointed counsel who would not adopt my motions, and therefore I had no rights to be heard in any matter regarding my case except through my attorneys. At one point, my attorney Paul Sullivan outright told me, quote, "It doesn't matter what you want done in your case," end quote. My attorneys did whatever they wanted to in my case, whenever they wanted to, and have had no regard for what I wanted done, or when I wanted it done. Only my attorneys would be recognized by the court. Clearly, my rights to due process and a speedy trial were violated by Florida criminal rule on state and federal constitutional grounds. I have now exhausted all of my state court remedies for the violations of my speedy trial status at the circuit court level on appeal at the Florida State Middle District Court and Florida Supreme Court levels. I am now seeking relief in the federal courts for violations of my due process and speedy trial rights as should be provided, and our personal rights to all citizens of every state of the United States. My attorney just handed me over to the state at trial. I might as well have not had any representation at all. My attorneys had held back on cross-examination of state witnesses. Vital witnesses that my attorney said would be called by the state and the defense were not called to testify. Only three witnesses and myself were called by the defense to testify, much to my surprise. My attorneys then rested my case, and I couldn't believe it, but there was nothing I could do. My attorneys led me to believe state witnesses would be called back to testify, and numerous other defense witnesses would be called to testify. This was not done. I had been held in jail for over 3 years, waiting to go to trial. My attorneys only put on a 45-minute defense at most in a capital case, where my very life is at stake for crimes I did not do. For over 3 years, this case had been tried in the news media by the state and investigative agencies. During a bond hearing in my case, Agent Ricky Hobbs got on the stand before the judge in a court of law to testify as to why I should not be allowed a bond. On cross-examination by my attorney, Brian Boyle, at that time, case agent Ricky Hobbs was asked if any reports concerning forensic evidence, blood, hair samples, car sweepings, and items seized from the condo and cars pursuant to search warrants had been returned. Case agent Ricky Hobbs stated that no reports on any of these had returned from the labs. Case agent Ricky Hobbs stated this on 3 occasions during his testimony in court. In fact, Ricky Hobbs had received over 16 reports back from various labs, all with favorable results for the defense. Several weeks before my trial was to start, case agent Ricky Hobbs approached the judge in my case, Judge Ellis, outside of court, where they engaged in an inappropriate conversation about my case. Ricky Hobbs has tampered with evidence and witnesses, altered witnesses' statements, and lied in court under oath when he repeatedly denied that any reports had returned from the police labs.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I had no way to know what was really discussed between Judge Ellis and case agent Ricky Hobbs. The defense then filed a motion to have Judge Ellis remove herself from my case by pointing out for the second time, by motion, to the court and state, case agent Ricky Hobbs' criminal actions in my case. Judge Ellis did remove herself from my case because the great amount of publicity in the news media about my case over the past 3 years, I discussed the possibility of a bench trial with my attorneys. On the advice of counsel, I chose a bench trial. I was told the only difference between a bench trial and a jury trial would be a judge, rather than a jury, would decide my case. This was not true, and by the time I realized how I was manipulated by the state and my own attorneys, it was too late. The defense had rested. I have been accused for over 3.5 years in the news media, by the police, and the state of being a serial killer, responsible for at least 6 deaths. And now I have been found guilty of the death of Richard Montgomery. The state says I offered money to guys to pose nude for pictures tied to a tree, at which time I would strangle the victim. I have been accused of mutilating victims by removing their genitals and/or dismembering the victim's body. This is not true. Not one speck of blood, not one hair, not one fingerprint, no DNA, no sperm, not one picture, not one cutting instrument that was used or believed used on Mr. Montgomery or any of the other bodies has been found. Not one eyewitness to any of the murders was found. Not one eyewitness can place me with Mr. Montgomery or any of the other victims at any time. Not one item that was or may have been Mr. Montgomery's or any of the other victims has ever been found in any of the searches of my condo, cars, boat, or any of my friends' houses. Since the police came up empty-handed in their search for evidence, their official response was not, "Since we can't find anything, Mr. Conahan may be innocent." On the contrary, the police and state said, "Since we can't find anything, Mr. Conahan must have it hidden someplace, like a you store it place." The police literally checked out almost all the you store it places in Florida and found nothing. To this day, the investigative agencies and the state say I must have a hiding place for the things I am supposed to have and the things they are looking for. I do not. What the state did present as evidence is one small paint chip the size of a 1/4 of a pinky fingernail, and the paint chip was not documented, yet shows up in an envelope submitted to a FDLE lab containing combings from Mr. Montgomery's pubic area. That paint chip was found to be consistent with the dark blue paint of the Capri. In her deposition, Mrs. Taylor, the state's paint chip expert, stated she could never say the paint found in the combings of Mr. Montgomery was from the Capri. The state also presented 5 fibers out of hundreds and hundreds of fibers from the vacuumings of the Capri and the condo that were found to be consistent with 1 fiber found on Mr. Montgomery's body, and 4 fibers found on the sheets and towels that were used to cover and transport Mr. Montgomery's body. In her deposition, Paula Sawyer, the state's fiber expert, stated she could never say any of the fibers found in the vacuumings of the Capri and condo matched or came from the same source with the fibers found on Mr. Montgomery's body or the sheets and towels used for transport. All vacuumings from the condo and cars were collected initially by investigators from CCSO, the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, under the direction of case agent Ricky Hobbs. A fuzzball the size of a cantaloupe was retrieved by vacuuming the Capri. This from a 12-year-old car that was not cleaned or vacuumed very often. That had been driven by many people, such as my mom, dad, sister, myself, mechanics, previous owners, etc., with fibers spanning 12 years of use. The same would apply to my parents' condo, and that I lived there with my parents. Between us all there, three large closets full of all kind of clothes, three large triple dressers full of clothes, carpets, drapes, etc., adding up to hundreds and thousands of fibers. All the state did was to look for similar fibers, not listing all the other types of fibers in the vacuumings of the Capri and the condo. The state did not retrieve vacuumings from the trailer of Mr. Montgomery's or any other trailers that he was known to have been at the day or the night that he was murdered. Those consistent fibers and more may have been retrieved in any or more of those trailers. There were no control vacuumings taken to compare with the vacuumings from the condo or cars of ours. I asked my attorney, Mark, to get the vacuumings from the above-mentioned trailers several times. My attorney, Mark, told me that he sent my co-counsel, Paul Sullivan, and my private investigator, Bill Clement, to retrieve the vacuumings that I had requested, only to find out later that my attorney had lied to me, and in fact had never sent anyone to retrieve vacuumings from any of the trailers. By then, it was too late, since most of the people in those trailers have moved or the trailers have been remodeled. I asked my counsel over and over to get an independent fiber expert to testify on the behalf of the defense, to review and interpret the state fiber analysis. My counsel would not do this, and since I had no direct access to the court, because the court would only address my attorneys, there was nothing I could do. The same applied when I asked my counsel for an independent paint expert. For these reasons, my defense was greatly impaired. It was also obvious at this point that my counsel did not have my best interests in mind. An unspecified body fluid was found on a hair from Mr. Montgomery's nude body that did not match my DNA, nor was the fluid of Mr. Montgomery's DNA. Although the hair the fluid was found on was Mr. Montgomery's. My attorney told me the state said the body fluid was probably sweat from one of the detectives when they bent over Mr. Montgomery's body. The state would not pay for the DNA screening of the detectives or any of the people that had been with Mr. Montgomery before he died. Yet, the investigative agencies in state have spent over $6 million to take me to trial. Contrary to the Florida rules of criminal procedure, the defense became aware of vital information withheld by case agent Ricky Hobbs and the state concerning Mr. Montgomery's uncle, Mr. James Bauman. A former Charlotte County Corrections officer contacted my private investigator, Bill Clement. She asked in her call on August 29, 1998, if he had heard of a James Bauman. It seems that Mr. Bauman was a suspect in a murder case involving a man, Mr. Reimers, who had been brutally murdered in an area similar to and mutilated in a similar manner as Mr. Montgomery was, here in Charlotte County. According to Terry, the former Charlotte County Corrections Officer, Mr. Reimers' penis had been severed and Mr. Bauman apparently participated in the mutilation. Mr. Bauman had received immunity for his testimony about the murder and concerning the other co-defendants in that crime. Mr. Bauman died on August 30, 1998, one day after Terry notified the defense about Mr. Bauman. Mr. Bauman was known to live in the Tropicana Apartments, a low-income transient apartment complex, and B. Holmes Bait Shop, both in close vicinity to each other. Holmes Bait Shop was then used as a place where transients lived. Three of the six murder victims can now be associated with B. Holmes Bait Shop. At one time, they lived and or hung out there, according to the police. Holmes Bait Shop was the first place Mrs. Montgomery, the victim, Mr. Montgomery's mother, went to look for her son when he did not show up at home the next day. Mr. Bauman is Mrs. Montgomery's brother. Terry also stated she had contacted case agent Ricky Hobbs and had notified him of Mr. Baumann several weeks after Mr. Montgomery's death. It was approximately 2 years after I was arrested when I found out about Mr. Baumann, the uncle of Mr. Montgomery, and his involvement in the uncanny similar mutilation murder. And again, case agent Ricky Hobbs and the state withheld this information from the defense. And by the time the defense knew of Mr. Baumann, he had died. The defense never had a chance to question or depose Mr. Baumann. It is now quite clear why case agent Ricky Hobbs, with the knowledge and approval of the state, has tampered with witnesses and evidence, altered witnesses' statements, withheld the information about Mr. Baumann, and perjured himself under oath in a court of law to keep out favorable evidence for the defendant. It's because the state and investigative agencies made a joint decision to criminally engage in these actions when and where needed in order to hide the fact that they had let the real murderer, Mr. Baumann, the uncle of the victim in my case, go on a plea bargain and as a result were directly responsible for those 6 deaths. I have documentation to support the accusations and statements I have made. I believe this case has taken on a life of its own, and no one really wants to hear the real truth after 3.5 years of trying this case in the news media by the state and investigative agencies here in Southwest Florida. All everyone wants is to see who they believe and have been led to believe is a serial killer, to be put to death in what has become a serial killer frenzy here in Southwest Florida. Ricky Hobbs has access to all of the evidence in this case, to include the vacuumings of the Capri, all contents of the Capri, peeling paint from the Capri, vacuumings and contents from the condo in which the defendant lived. Ricky Hobbs has handled and touched crucial evidence, such as a coat around and near the crime scene, and carpet padding found covering Mr. Montgomery's body. Similar actions by case agent Ricky Hobbs reached back to 1992, when a Mr. Popejoy claimed Detective Ricky Hobbs tampered with a tape recording of a police interview conducted by Detective Ricky Hobbs. The tape was sent to the FBI for analysis. Assistant State Attorney Allison Drani stated in his report that the FBI report tended to corroborate Mr. Popejoy's assertion that the evidence had been altered or tampered with. Mr. Popejoy was then offered a deal, and there was no trial. In the guilt phase of my trial, key witnesses for the state perjured themselves under oath with the state's knowledge to implicate me with the death of Mr. Montgomery. One of these witnesses is the victim's mother, Mrs. Mary Montgomery West. Mrs. Montgomery verified that her son told her that a Mr. Conahan had asked him to pose nude for pictures in the woods in bondage and wanted to pay him to do so. Montgomery stated she remembered the name Conahan because at the time she talked to her son, she had thought that the name was similar to the name of some friends of her family, by the name of Conaghan. Mrs. Montgomery continued in her trial testimony to state she told the police all of this in her police interview on April 18, 1996, 2 days after her son had been killed. The statement Mrs. Montgomery said she told the police is not reflected in the transcript of her police interview. When asked about that, Mrs. Montgomery said it was at the point where the transcript shows there's an inaudible sentence said. I asked my private investigator, Bill Clement, a former Charlotte County Sheriff Detective, to the state attorney's office to listen to the tape of Mrs. Montgomery's police interview. Although the tape was of poor quality and was a copy of a copy, the police would not let Bill Clement listen to the original tape. Bill Clement stated that the content of the tape of Mrs. Montgomery's police interview did not reflect what she testified to in court. If Mrs. Montgomery had told the police that her son Richard had been asked by a Mr. Conahan to pose for nude pictures tied up, it would have been all through my case paperwork, and the state would have brought it up at trial. The state didn't. I asked my attorneys to play the tape in court. They refused to play it. The second key witness to perjure under oath in court called to testify was Robert Whitaker. Mr. Whitaker testified that I had come to his trailer looking for Richard Montgomery after first going to Mr. Montgomery's sister's trailer looking for Mr. Montgomery, at which time Mr. Montgomery's sister sent me to Mr. Whitaker's trailer to find Mr. Montgomery. Mr. Whitaker said he told me Mr. Montgomery was not there, and I left. Well, this is not what Mr. Whitaker stated in his third police interview, or his deposition in which he was also under oath to tell the truth. What Mr. Whitaker did say in his third interview to police was that I came to his trailer looking for Mr. Montgomery after first going to Mr. Montgomery's sister's trailer. That Mr. Montgomery was there, and Mr. Montgomery and I talked for about 45 minutes because we had not seen each other for a while. Mr. Whitaker further said in his third police interview that I also came to his trailer on two other occasions where I'd met and left with Mr. Montgomery. One time, Mr. Whitaker said Mr. Montgomery and I were gone for about an hour, and the other time, Mr. Whitaker said, Mr. Montgomery and I were gone a short time. Both times, Mr. Whitaker stated that Mr. Montgomery and I came back with beer. In Mr. Whitaker's deposition, taken after his third police interview, he was asked how many times Mr. Conahan had come to his trailer looking for Mr. Montgomery. He replied, truthfully, I can remember only one time, the initial first time, but Mr. Montgomery was not there. Mr. Whitaker went on to say in his deposition that he had never seen Mr. Montgomery and Mr. Conahan together at any time. Mr. Whitaker then stated that there was a mix-up and it was someone else he was thinking of. Against my request, my attorneys refused to question Mr. Whitaker about these statements at the guilt or penalty phase of my trial. At the guilt phase of my trial, both Mr. Montgomery's sister Carla and her ex-husband Jeff both testified that they did not know me, nor had they ever seen me before. The third and last key witness to perjure under oath with the state's knowledge was John Newman. And that was the 22-page letter that Daniel Conahan sent to a news outlet. Richard's mom, Mary, said she hopes Daniel Conahan meets God. Quote, if he truly believes he has a right to walk in heaven with God's faithful, he's one of God's children too. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I know we all get in tight binds financially, but if there's one thing that I beg of you is to never take offers from strangers where you're going to be vulnerable and alone. I mean, we can't even fully trust the people we do know, which is scary enough. I also understand a lot of people are sex workers and they put themselves in harm's way every single day to provide for themselves and or their children. It just terrifies me so much because each situation that you make it out of just fine, the next could be completely different, which is definitely another topic I want to cover. Sex workers who are missing, murdered, or who have been victims or survivors of six types of human trafficking. There's truly so much to discuss about all of those things. And to anyone listening who may be in those extremely difficult financial situations and you put yourself in harm's way every day, I truly hope that you can get out of that line of work someday. And I hope the best for you always. And I hope you do have something to defend yourself with, just in case anything ever were to happen. Again, thank you so much for listening. Now I want to take a moment to thank my wonderful Patreon members. Thank you so much, Lorraine, Denise, Kara, Justin, Miss Red, Jade, Marianne, Jamie, Iris, Jimmy, Melissa, Shannon, Joe, Matt, Chelsea, Ian, Shayna, Liz, Maggie, Trevor, Angel, Sapper, TZ, Corey, Tyler, and Kimberly. The Patreon is $3 a month. I put up a poll every month with different cases, urban legends, cryptids, and more that you can vote on for the Patreon exclusive episode of the month, which I have been doing since October 2020. There are also ad-free early releases of these episodes and 10 bonus episodes up as of this recording. And there are also those episodes that I deleted from the public feed that are still on Patreon. As I've said, I do still want to redo those episodes and do them more justice. So some of you may not have heard those before, if you're a new listener. They are not the greatest, and I will admit that, but it will also give you more episodes to listen to if you want. I'm also sending out a medium-sized package to all Patreon members starting in August. I usually send a sticker and a magnet to new members, but I've added a few more things that I want to send out as a thank you for your extra support. That's $3 a month at patreon.com/reverietruecrime. Until next time, please stay safe and take care. Love you guys.